Good morning. You are listening to the Virtual Coffee Shop Podcast with Mark Carbone, and today I'm thrilled to be joined by Shannon Clark and Stephen Hurley for what I think will be a very interesting conversation about something that we'll let Shannon tell you about in a minute. So I'm going to offer Shannon the mic here for a moment just to introduce herself.
Hi there. Good morning, everybody. I've always had a love of food, and the reason that my company is called For the Love of Food. But my original career started as a physiotherapist, and I graduated from the University of Toronto in 92. And my first position was with outpatient orthopedics with patients that were diabetic, many homeless with foot ulcers. And so I got very involved in treating ulcers right out of the fence there. And what I learned was a really, really valuable lesson. Actually, Mark, should we get into this right now, or should we actually do a bit less?
Stephen, did you want to introduce yourself?
So I'm Stephen Hurley, and I guess my role in this conversation is one of an interested observer. So I am the chief catalyst at Voicehead Radio and happy to welcome Shannon Clark and Mark Carbone here this morning.
Great. Thank you, Stephen. Well, one of the things that I've always been interested in is the idea of synchronicity. And that's really the link to how Shannon and I became connected. So it turned out our daughter and her boyfriend gave us tickets for Christmas, tickets to choose a cooking class and participate in a lovely evening in Toronto. So we chose the Maritime cooking option at Dish Studios, and we went through a process along with about 20 other people of preparing a seafood oriented meal and learning all kinds of tips and tricks on food prep and spices, things to do, things not to do. And we get the meal all prepared over about a 2-hour period, at which time we change roles. The instructors then become the servers, and those of us that signed up for the class, we sit down and enjoy the meal that we prepared as a group. So in our table setting, by complete happenstance, I'm sitting along with my wife, Deborah, kitty corner to Shannon and her husband. And of course, you know, in that kind of a context, we're chatting food, chatting prep, and getting to know each other, and what do you do and what do I do and so on. And bingo, there was Shannon, and she was able to sort of tell us about her journey from what she introduced herself as and her work background to her current project. So I'm going to turn the mic over to Shannon and let her talk about her journey and goals here with her company. But there's some very interesting health and wellness and curriculum extensions with this project. And I'm so grateful that things played out, that I was able to meet Shannon in this sort of synchronicity type of context. So Shannon, thanks for choosing the same cooking class as we did, and over to you.
All right. So please feel free to interrupt and ask as many questions as you want. I have this, I can talk and talk and talk, as you can see. So by all means, please hop in with any questions.
I sure will.
Good. So as I was saying, the job I first had when I graduated was with diabetics. And it was really interesting because we learned really early on that if you give the ideal environment to the body, it's the body that heals itself, not the nurse or the physio or the doctor. So what we did with these patients was we'd clean their wound, we'd make sure it stayed moist, not dry, not wet, we'd protect it, and we would reduce the swelling. And that's where the physio really came in, was to get the swelling out of the leg so that the blood supply would be better to this ulcer. And sure enough, we'd have these wounds healing without us doing anything other than setting up the ideal environment. So after 12 years of working in the diabetic world, I landed another position at the other end of the diabetic spectrum. And that was with women who were in their 40s at a fitness center who were being told that they were pre-diabetic and this was increasing their risk of heart disease. And yet these women had access to good health care and access to good nutrition, and they were in the gym being fit, and they didn't know what was going on. So I thought to myself, okay, well, given the ideal environment, the body can heal itself. So what's this environment that's not allowing the body to maintain a homeostasis to keep them healthy? And you realize when you have an increased risk of diabetes, it's because you're having a long-term high blood sugar issue. And so what were these women doing that were causing them to have high blood sugar? Well, high blood sugar comes in all kinds and shapes and forms. It's not all about eating just sugar. And can I make a point here? I see a lot of articles and I hear a lot of people saying, oh yeah, sugar's bad. It's you know, it's what's causing all the diabetes and heart disease. And it's like, well, you can't really blame sugar. It's like blaming a car for the car accident. So if you're just going to avoid not driving, then sure, you'll never be in a car accident, but that's not the solution.
Shannon, I'm wondering if I can just jump in here and ask, you described two different work scenarios, and you're obviously inquisitive and a reflective thinker. You're thinking about these critical questions. How long did you work in those fields to start to see these patterns, connections, and develop this sort of questioning of what was happening?
It wasn't long because of I was working at a charity hospital, and the diabetics were being brought into the ER, and then they were sent up to the physiotherapy department to be put into a whirlpool. And kind of being a young grad, I was like, oh, this isn't right. We should not be putting these patients' legs in a dependent position when they already have swelling. There's got to be a better solution. And I knew my mom, who was a VON nurse, she was doing something called an Uniboot, where it was like a soft cast that you would put on a diabetic's leg so that it would do all those things, protect, stay moist, and apply compression so that the blood supply would be close to the ulcer. And so my mom was a big influence on me and said, why don't you try seeing if the hospital will let you do some Uniboots? And so I started doing that, and I would say to this homeless patient, okay, be back in a week and I'll take it off and I'll put another one on. And they'd come back in 3 months. And that Uniboot was still in place, and it wasn't exactly clean, but the wound was clean because the wound was inside. Sure enough, we cut off these casts, and 3 months, that wound was almost cleaned. And it was remarkable because so many people had said, well, they're diabetic, they're never going to heal. And I'm like, well, these guys are healing and they're diabetic. And, you know, again, that ideal environment. So it was very early on, I started taking courses in wound care. So probably within the first year of graduating, I was all over the wound care world because you could see results, and it wasn't what they would tell us. They'd say diabetics don't heal well. I'm like, well, these guys are healing. Right. So then when I came back, or when I, you know, started the other position 12 years later, I was like, don't tell me to eat less and exercise more is working, because it's not. There's another issue here that we need to figure out.
So you were in an environment then where you were exposed to these kind of health conditions all the time. You've got the background from your mom. So to me, that sort of, I'm interested in that part of the story, because that sort of sets the stage for trying these new ideas. Obviously, where you worked was receptive to trying some different things in the efforts to advanced patient care to a better level.
Right. It was, you just nailed it on the head. And I guess I didn't really realize this, but it was early on that I was starting to question what was being told by, you know, the World Health Organization or whatever, realizing we were healing these wounds. And we ended up setting up a wound center where surgeons were sending us, you know, patients, because we had a bit of a reputation for healing wounds no matter what. And so I think you're right. That's the point when I started realizing, okay, just because they're saying this, it might not necessarily be true. And that's exactly what's happened. I've really kind of been very critical of what's come out of, you know, what kind of diet, everybody says that the low carb diet is best, or that, you know, not eating sugar, or you should be exercising, doing cardio rather than weights, or weights for cardio. I'm like, really? I don't know. I think it's become a real individual thing. And that's kind of where, what I've stuck with. So I guess at that point I had these, you know, 40-year-old women, and I said, well, you say you're eating well, and I see that, you know, you've got, you know, you think you're doing the right thing. Could you just write out what you're eating? So I love math, and they wrote out exactly what they were eating. And I said, tell me the amounts, and even tell me the brands. And so what I did was I just did all the numbers for how many carbs they were eating, and I transferred into calories, and how much fat and fiber and protein, and I transferred all into calories. And I couldn't believe it, but the five women that gave me their week's nutrition plan, they were eating at around 68 to 75% carbohydrates. But they were eating whole grains and fruits and vegetables. And I mean, at lunchtime, they would have a bowl the size of a mixing bowl that would have lettuce and peppers and tomatoes and cucumbers and you name it, all the things that we are being, you know, preached to eat all the time. And yet their carbohydrate ratios were just so high. So I thought, your body isn't getting a chance at all to not have high sugar. No wonder you're all coming in with a what's called a glycosylating hemoglobin score that's higher than normal.
That's such an interesting scenario where you could sort of glean insights into this just from a simple daily food log. To me, it's a great example of, things always seem so complex, and yet somehow you were able to zero in on some very specific things that had an unexpected relationship in terms of diet and how your body processes.
Yeah. And again, and everybody processes things differently. I mean, you've got body types out there who are the more ectomorph, which is that lean, long kind of runway model or long distance runner, who don't have high muscle mass, but are very sensitive to blood sugars and tend to be more hypoglycemic, meaning their blood pressures yo-yo, or their blood sugars, pardon me, yo-yo, and they need a higher level of carbohydrates. But then you have the, you know, dare I say, Oprah body type, or more endomorph body type, who don't do as well with carbohydrates, and therefore they require a higher fat or protein ratio. And it's interesting, because if you were to take a long distance runner and give her a high fat diet, chances are she'd sit on the couch with not a whole lot of energy, but give a high fat or protein diet to Oprah and mm-hmm. she's all over the stage, like, you know, and vice versa. Everybody is really different, and it plays more than just body type. It's your genetics. It's where you come from. It's what's available, you know, what's local and seasonal that you're used to eating. There's all kinds of factors. So really getting people to decide what they should be eating and what makes them feel good and what energizes them is really the ticket. And I think that's where we've gone wrong, is that, you know, diets haven't failed us. We've failed diets because we haven't figured out the diet that's actually for us individually.
You know, I'm interested that you describe things that way, but I can think of conversations that Stephen and I have had around, I think, Stephen, we called it paintbrush mode, where, you know, in, you know, education, everybody should do this and everybody should do that. And, you know, and while sometimes that thinking is good on the surface in sort of an educational classroom context, it really comes down to, it's the same principle. Each student is a unique individual, and I think the talent of an educator is knowing the students and how to create a safe learning environment, but nudging them along through the curriculum in individualized ways, and not just doing paintbrush mode, if I can come back to that kind of analogy. Stephen, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I did. I want, because I think as human beings, we've been conditioned, or maybe we haven't been conditioned. Maybe we just like other people telling us what to do, you know, whether it's in our personal lives or in our work lives, we love knowing that we're doing the right thing. And I've gone through a number of different diets over the years, and most recently at Christmas time went on that the low carb diet, and you know, went through the withdrawal of that, and I'm just wondering, Shannon, how do we as human beings living in a world where there's so much information and so many conflicting perspectives, how do we get into the conversation in a different way? How do we begin it? How do we integrate that conversation into our lives in a way that allows us to become more critical thinkers and more responsive to our own bodies?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I often will say to people, you know, when you say to me, just give me a diet, just make me up a diet, and I swear I'll just eat exactly what you tell me to eat. And I'm like, I can't. It's like, you know, you saying, just pick a house for me that you know I'm going to love, or just pick a partner for me that you know is perfect. It's like, you can't. Everybody's such an individual. You really have to do the work yourself. But you can keep something in mind. And I call it the 80-10-10 rule. And what it basically says is that 80% of the population will be fine with whatever it is. They'll be fine with penicillin. They'll be fine with the school system. They'll be fine with, you know, living in the city. 10% will just thrive in it. They'll thrive with penicillin and they'll thrive in the school system. 10% will find it toxic. So in every single diet that you look at, if you're going to choose somebody else's diet, say to yourself, do I love it? Is it really great for me? Am I finding it really hard? Is it giving me bad blood work? Is it, you know, is it making me feel sick? And whether you can sustain it. And then just realize, okay, everybody's an individual. I should be able to tweak it. And Canada's Food Guide actually says the same thing. Now, not the new one, because the new one, we've only seen the first part of it, the first part of three. But the old food guides, the one in the handbook, it says that 80% of the population will eat this way, meaning four food groups and eating within those macronutrient ranges, which I'll talk about in a minute. 10% will eat more than this, and 10% will eat less than this. And so it's the perfect rule. Just remember, are you in the 80%? Are you in the 10% or the other 10%?
You know what? You're talking about blood work and you're talking about listening to your body and feeling good. How do we get those biofeedback mechanisms working for us? I mean, short of going every few weeks to the doctor and asking for a blood work requisition, how can we monitor the important symptoms, the important criteria that our body is speaking, the language that our body is speaking? How can we do that as lay people?
Well, it's the biggest thing is, are you in control of your appetite? And I can't say enough that, like when I said the body will heal itself, the body is really in control. So when you come in the door and you haven't been able to have lunch, and the first thing you grab is a tub of ice cream out of the fridge or a bag of potato chips or something, that's not your willpower failing you. That's your body from the inside screaming that your blood sugar is low and you're about to pass out, throw up, or have a severe headache if you don't get your blood sugar up. And so for me, when I'm working with people and they're using the app or they're on the website, is that the number one thing is you should be in control of your diet, so that when you walk in the door, you aren't grabbing for everything to get yourself back to a static place. So you can look at that. Are you eating after dinner? Because if you're eating after dinner, you haven't had enough calories during the day. And that's the only reason. It's not because you're sitting there watching TV and you're bored, or because a commercial comes on with Orville Redenbacher. That has nothing to do with it. The body is absolutely in control, and it is a biochemical response that you are having that, oh, I'm hungry, my blood sugars are dropping. Another thing is regularity. A lot of people find that when they start getting enough calories and they're balancing their ratios of carbohydrates to fats and proteins, their regularity improves, their sleeping improves, they feel like going for a walk, you know, their hair starts growing back better. These are all really, really, really easy ways of knowing whether or not you're eating the right diet for you. And diet meaning not the diet for losing weight or burning body fat. The diet is the food that you eat that keeps your body, right, you know, in homeostasis.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I'm listening to the two of you dialogue here, I mean, my mind is reflecting on all of the different eating and exercise regimes that I've tried over the years. And I would say, really, until the last 2 or 3 years, I've had a lot more success. And I'm seeing that some of my success, although it's not really been through your lens, Shannon, but those are the variables that I am getting much better control on. So at this point in time, I can say I do sleep some better, and I'm keep working on that. My, you know, I'll call it light exercise and way better understanding of what I eat in the quantities. Those things are all interacting for me now in a different way. And I think that's partly what really stirred my interest in our initial conversations. Because I was listening to what you were saying, I could see, yeah, this is working in my own life. I can see it. I need to learn more about this. So I do feel a very personal connection to this conversation. And maybe this is a good segue into sort of the next phase. You shared with me at the cooking class that your passion was, how can I take all of these things that I've learned, I've experienced, I've witnessed in these different work environments, and have an impact on the public? And by public, I mean including raising awareness, not just for adults, but also for students and making some foray into the education world in terms of wellness. So I'm wondering if you might share a little bit about your website and what's happening there. And you've just launched a wonderful new app as part of this wanting to make an impact. So I'd love for you to share with our listeners a little bit about those elements.
Sure, that's great. I released the first app in 2012 called Food Lover, and it's called For the Love of Food, and I spell it the number 4, and then love is L-U-V, so For the Love of Food. And it was getting people to learn how to balance their carbohydrates with their fats and proteins. So that came out in 2012, and that's when I had started my pilot studies, because I was really questioning, is Canada's food guide right? If we are supposed to be eating half of our calories as carbohydrates and the other half as fats and proteins, then is it really, do we really do get good health results, you know, either systemically and subjectively and objectively or not? So I ran a 5-year pilot study teaching people how to balance their carbohydrates with their fats and proteins. And sure enough, I couldn't prove it wrong. They would get blood work back that said, yep, their cholesterol levels were good, and their glycosylating hemoglobin, which looked at their diabetic risk factor, they were improving, and their thyroid levels were improving. And so I realized I just have to get it out there. So I started building a second app about a year and a half ago, after I'd finished my pilot study and after I'd got some support from the government in a funny way. I ended up December 2015, after the 5-year pilot study, I reached out to the Minister of Health with this idea, reached out to Health Canada, and reached out to Senator Kelvin Ogilvie. And Senator Kelvin Ogilvie had chaired the committee that wrote the obesity report, which came out in October of 2016. And it was a brilliant research piece that was so well written and so easy to read. And they basically interviewed as many people in the food industry as they could, the experts on salt and the experts on fat, and came out with the science behind food and how, you know, salt, again, falls on almost under that 80-10-10 rule, where 15% of the population is toxic to salt, and they know who they are. And then 85% of the population has no problem with salt. So I was working with Senator Kelvin Ogilvie, and he invited me when I sent him my pilot study, because basically what I had done was I had said, if we eat a balanced diet, we will see improved measurable outcomes, especially in blood markers. And I'd gone to the Dean of Nutrition at Ryerson, and I'd said to her, I'm a physiotherapist, I'm doing this pilot study. And she said, okay, you can't have any subjective results. You need everything to be objective. So you're going to have to look at blood work. And that's what I did. I had people give me their blood work after 3 months of doing the balancing. And that was where my pilot study. So I sent that off to the senator, and the senator called me the next day and he said, can you come to Ottawa? And I said, absolutely. And so I went to Ottawa, and he was absolutely on board, because what he knew that I didn't know was that Health Canada was working on a food labeling system that would identify foods high in fats, high in sugar, and high in salt. And he said, your solution for teaching people how to balance the macronutrients is exactly what Health Canada needs, so that you can have a product with a label on it, which is just a number, which I'll talk about in a second, that doesn't demonize the product. So where you would put a high fat label on butter, that means, oh, that's not good. But butter's a good product. It's been around forever. It's a traditional food, and it's a good source of fat. So my solution was teaching people how to look at a food and know if it was high in carbohydrate, low in carbohydrate, or a nice balance of carbohydrates to fats and proteins. And so what this app has done is it's encouraged people to balance their foods and their meals to keep their blood sugars stable. And how it works is this. You look at the nutritional facts label and you look at the carbohydrate grams. Don't worry about the percentages. Those are for a person with a 2000 calorie diet. So you look at your carbohydrate grams, and from that gram total, you subtract fiber, fat, and protein grams. And if the number comes out close to zero, you have a balance of carbohydrates to fats, proteins, and fiber. If that number comes out really high, so you go to a juice place or a smoothie place, for example, and you do your numbers and your smoothie comes out to a 72, you know that that's a very high carb meal. If it comes out very, very negative, you know that it's a very low carb meal. But if it comes out around zero, you know that that product has a nice balance of fats, carbohydrates, and proteins. So then you take that one step further and you take your butter, which is a tablespoon is a negative 12, and you take your bread, which could be a 12, and you come out at zero. Well, what do you know? A piece of bread and butter is balanced in fats, carbohydrates, and proteins. And that's the premise behind it. And so from there, the senator was, you got to get the rest of the world on board. And so that's what I've been doing, working on an app called Balanced Cafe, which just came out last week, and the website, which is called fortheloveoffood.com or .ca.
That's such a great story. And, you know, I'm listening to you describe about the labeling and, you know, relatively simple calculation. And I know you and I have had conversations about, well, what could this look like in the school system, you know, impacting health by influencing how people, you know, I think go back to Stephen's term around, you know, self-awareness, like your own unique situation. How can I relate to the data, get these indicators? Obviously, we can't all go and get blood tests all the time, but the tools that you're developing here could easily be used to guide and influence how people manage their eating choices over a lifetime, really.
Yes. Oh, and that's exactly what we're looking at, is we're looking at a lifestyle change and not just something that you do to get results and then you can't sustain. It's an absolute lifestyle change. It's an awareness of the value of food that we've lost over the generations, because there's not a matriarch taking care of everybody in the family by putting the meal on the table and then everybody else worrying about the other parts of living. So what's really come of this, and I'm really, really pleased about, is my oldest daughter and her husband are school teachers, and they've put together a grade 8 math curriculum, media literacy curriculum, and or I shouldn't say curriculum, I guess they're units that follow the Ontario education curriculum. And it teaches kids ratios and percentages and quantities, all using the nutrition facts labels. So in the end, they're able to evaluate personal food choices on a variety of criteria, which would be serving size, nutrient content, energy value, macro, micronutrient ingredients, all factors that affect health and wellness. So at the beginning of the unit, they take the nutritional facts label in an Excel spreadsheet and they gather their information, and then they start tweaking it and they change serving sizes, and then they can take their grams and turn them into calories, and then they can take their calories and they can look at a percentage of calories in your total meal. And then in the end, they put together a dinner party, a virtual dinner party, to make sure that they are serving a balanced meal to whoever they're serving to. And then at the end, they say, "Oh, now we're going to teach you what's called the balance factor." And the balance factor is just the algebraic equation used to determine if the food item, the food item's macronutrient content, which is exactly the carbs minus fiber, fat, and protein. And then to take that one step further, you then throw food products at the kids and say, "So which one's healthier?" And they'll see these beautiful packaging that says, you know, organic, or, and nothing wrong with organic, but, or it's high in fiber, or it's, lowers cholesterol and it's green. And then you look at another food item of the same category and it's not showing all that stuff, but the nutrient content comes out better. And then kids are taught not to look at the marketing, but to actually look at the product's content and say, "This is a much more balanced meal."
I love that you described that way. And Stephen, I'm going to segue to you, because you zeroed in on this idea of how does each of us as an individual become a better critical thinker in this space.
And this is kind of exciting, because I, first of all, I buy apps that, you know, promise to help me balance things. So I'm a prime candidate for this. But I'm wondering, Shannon, is this a consideration, and does this thinking ideally happen at the point of purchase, at the meal planning or recipe gathering stage, or is it both? And how do you kind of manage this? Does your shopping experience need to take an hour longer now, which is fine for me because I love grocery shopping? Where does the effort come in? Where does the critical thinking come in, at the supermarket or in the kitchen?
Oh, it comes in right off the bat. And this is the part that's really fun, because we've lost the value of food, and because we've lost our culture of being passed down what to eat, when to eat it, who to eat it with, why to eat it. You know, it's a whole new world for us again, because you take a look at something that's got pistachio nuts in it and something else, and you realize it's a zero and you go, "Oh, that pistachio nut bar is a perfect balance. That's fantastic." And and then, you know, you've got permission to eat it, and it's going to help you. So it's in the grocery store. It's in your looking at your plate, and it doesn't have to be accurate, because the bottom line is, unless we were all hooked up to a VO2 max machine to see how many calories we're burning at any given time, it's a ballpark how many calories we burn. So if I burn, you know, 2200 one day, probably another day I'm burning 2305. Like it's just something that you kind of, you know, have to ballpark. So when you're looking at your plate, you see your English muffin, and then you fry an egg, and that English muffin and the egg, well, that's, you know, a balance, because, you know, your English muffin is a 13 and your egg is a negative 12 by looking at the package. And if we could get we could get Health Canada on board and get them to put the balance factor in the top right corner of the nutritional facts label. Sorry, I've got kids here again. Guys, guys, I'm doing a podcast. Can you quiet down? Sorry, I've got my university kids home from school for the summer and just getting used to the house dynamics again. If we can get Health Canada to put that little number in the top right-hand corner of the nutritional facts label where there's a bit of a parking lot, a parking spot there, then people can very quickly take a look at that package and say, that bread is a 14 and this bread's a 7, I'm going to grab the 7 because it means that that bread has a higher level, a percentage of fiber, fat, and protein in it than the other bread.
Can I jump in with one more? And you mentioned the relationship we have with food. And one of the things that I'm aware of in my own life as I've tried to look at labels and teach my kids to look at labels. And we've been, you know, focusing on discrete things like sugar and carbohydrates, fiber and things like that, salt. How do we at the same time maintain and maybe even recapture a love and an enjoyment of sharing food and cooking food together and not have to be too concerned about that? How do we develop a lifestyle that respects the facts and the data, but also respects the relationship with food?
Oh, I think it's just a matter of, you know, balancing your meals, because we really are creatures of habit, and you probably have 4 or 5 breakfasts that you love and maybe a change on the weekend. And you know, we pretty much stick to our main lunches. I mean, and what you realize when you're using the app is that a half of a bagel is the same as 7 crackers, is the same as 2 pieces of sourdough bread, is the same as an English muffin. Mm. I mean, you can interchange those with 3 slices of ham or 2/3 of a cup of egg salad, or, you know, and you start realizing that as you're building these meals, and you can use the app to build the meals, that these meals are all coming out around the same calories and all coming out around the same balance factor, and they're all interchangeable. And our ancestors knew this without needing an app, and they knew this without doing the math, because it sustained them. Mm-hmm. And they also didn't have the variety of foods that we have in the grocery store now. So I just think it comes with build the meals you love to eat, realize the balance factor of them, tweak them by either taking out a little bit of the carb or adding a little bit more of the fats and proteins. And you're very quickly won't need the app. You'll just know these 5 breakfasts are perfect for me. These 7 lunches are exactly the same. These snacks are ideal, and then dinner can fluctuate. And dinner's usually the easiest because you end up having a grain, either a pasta or a rice or potatoes, with a vegetable and generally a meat source or an all meat alternative, right? So it's just once you get the hang of the meals that you really love, then it becomes a no-brainer, really.
You've got me thinking about lunch already. It's only 11 o'clock in the morning.
But listen, if you're hungry, it's because your body's telling you something. Yes. And okay, so now this is the other part of the app, which has been, I have just been so thrilled with, is it ensures that people are eating enough. And everybody says, oh, I'm eating enough. You wouldn't believe how much I eat. And of course, we've been told since the 1970s to eat less and exercise more, which has not helped us. And so there's a built-in graphing system on the app. So you have to just put in your meals, and it automatically graphs your calories and your balance factor. So then you can take a look at the graph by just tapping a button and realize you're not eating enough if you haven't gotten into that green zone, which is the number of calories that are required to keep your basal metabolic rate going. And people are always shocked. They're like, I'm not eating enough. It's like, and there you go. So you're likely in a starvation mode, and that's why you can't get that excess body fat off.
Right. Now, I'm interested in... you know, of course, I'm listening to this and Stephen's comments, and I'm thinking about the importance of role modeling. And Stephen, you indicated you're you know, talking to your kids about, you know, eating habits and helping them learn to inform themselves. And what an exciting opportunity to really not only embrace and improve lifestyles, but to influence your kids and give them healthy eating skills that will, you know, hopefully continue throughout their whole lives.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do with, you know, get it into the education system and get it onto those nutritional facts label, and then it teaches everybody. And the equation is simple. It's a grade 3 level math, but if we don't even need to do that equation, then everybody can get it without requiring numeracy or literacy skills, or there's no language barrier.
I like it.
So, I mean, it's been a real it's been a real blessing meeting you, Mark, because you being able to have a foot into the education system and maybe getting it up to some communities that, you know, don't have access to as much, I guess, nutritional stuff. And to that point, I mean, one thing that has I've been very critical about with the whole eat lots of fruits and vegetables and that kind of stuff is, well, first of all, we live in Canada. We don't grow fruits and vegetables all year round. Nobody grows fruits and vegetables all year round. And what about the communities that can't access fruits and vegetables? And those communities have survived. And I mean, they've been healthy. And so I don't think we should be dependent on fruits and vegetables. There's lots of ways to get our proper balance of macronutrients. And we just have to be able to know which foods to eat and combine in order to make sure the body gets what it needs and has that ideal environment.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I know I shared with you earlier that I've sort of talked through the whole concept of this with a couple of schools that I've had the pleasure of working with recently, and they're eager to learn more and look at perhaps including this in their sort of grade 7, 8, 9 plans for next year. So I'm excited to see how that turns out as well.
Very, very exciting. So, and I think the app is free and it will stay free because everybody should be able to access a way to good nutrition, no matter where they live, what, you know, economic level they're at, what education they have. Everybody should be able to have good nutrition, and it doesn't have to come all through, you know, expensive foods. So if the more people that can download the app and show Health Canada that all we need is a little number in the top right corner of that nutritional facts label, the better. So this is great.
It's the make it easy factor.
It is. It's the make it easy factor, but not to not educate the person. And I think by being dependent on the food industry to, you know, make sure we're eating right is not the right solution. I think we need an element of education to go along with a tool. And those seem to be the best combinations of successful things, like seatbelts with driver's ed and soap with, you know, how to wash your hands properly. Those are all very effective tools. And I think I'm hoping that the balance factor and an education program, especially starting in grade 8, would be very helpful for reducing our obesity and reducing our risk of diabetes and heart disease, and hopefully not having to spend so much money in that direction.
So. Perfect. Well, I want to...
I'm inspired. Inspired.
I want to thank both of you for taking the time to join me this morning and have this insightful and I'll say delightful conversation. I'm excited to see where all of this goes, Shannon. I'm so impressed with the work and research that you've done and your passion for making a difference for others. So congratulations to you.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been great working with you, that's for sure. And lovely to meet you, Stephen.
You've been listening to the Virtual Coffee Shop Podcast with Mark Carbone and guests. Thanks for tuning in.